Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
You're tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis, on this extremely frigid winter day. Frigid. Right. Day 31 of the government shutdown. Come on,
Boo.
Trump, do something. Boo you. But we have a great show. It's going to be red hot in here. In a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking about the hospitality miracle. That is the Lebanese Taverna. It grew from one little thing to now it's mushroomed to, what, you got 10,000 restaurants? Something like that. Lebanese Taverna, which is the...
Nothing like a little accurate journalism here on our radio show.
The Mediterranean restaurant in D.C. No matter where you go, there's one on every corner. There should be one at our house because I'm there so much. Mm-hmm. But first... We're going to talk about something very special for those government employees that are suffering out there with this stupid shutdown.
Well, absolutely. Americans across the country want to help federal workers furloughed. And, I mean, people in the restaurant industry have been incredibly, incredibly generous. But we have two people in studio who have come up with something completely different, and it has totally taken off. Al Goldberg, you may know him from Mess Hall, and Nevin Martell, who is... God, he's got a long list of things that he does, but he's the restaurant critic for DC Modern Luxury. He's a book author, a cookbook author. Anyway, the two of you got together.
He's also a continental man about town.
Yes, okay, he's a bon vivant.
Wow, I was waiting for David to chip in with something.
Bon vivant. I like bon vivant. Anyway, but you guys have come up with this concept called payitfurlough.com. It has completely taken off. Tell us all about it.
Well, it's super simple, first of all. It's a website where people around the country, and in fact, we found out throughout the world, can go and fund beers for furloughed federal workers and contractors in the D.C. area who can then walk into any one of our four participating partners, D.C. Brow, Three Stars, Atlas, and Shop Made in D.C., and claim as many free beers as they'd like as long as there are beers in the fund.
It should have been called Drown Your Sorrows.
Well, we want people to enjoy it responsibly. Right. You know, like, to be honest, like, a lot of it is about creating a community and camaraderie for these people that want to get out of the house. They want to talk about what's going on, or maybe they want to talk about something completely different. Mm-hmm. But, you know, from the people that we've talked to, because we've been to a couple of the tap rooms, you know, people really just would rather be back at work.
Of course.
But this is a nice way to kind of pass an afternoon, maybe get out of the house if a spouse is giving you a hard time, because, you know, you're not there all the time usually,
right.
And here you are now.
Oh,
wait,
I haven't been... You know, shut down, and my wife is still giving me a hard time.
Well, so. David, that's something to talk to your therapist about.
That's what happens, right? We've been married for a really long time.
Yeah.
That's what happens. But so, how did you guys come up with the concept? Because it looks like it came together very quickly and then caught fire very fast.
Yeah. Well, it's
right
interesting.
Under this roof, huh?
I was going to say it's interesting that we're doing the interview here because we actually had the idea at Spoken English.
Oh, wow.
Like a week and a half ago.
How fabulous.
Yeah. So you want to talk about how it came about?
No, but honey, you're going to have to... You can move it. You can touch it. It's not going to bite you. There you go.
Put your mouth on it.
There you go. No, not him.
Touch it, Al. Touch it.
This show is off to such a bad start.
I want to get a photo of Al.
No video. No video this morning.
I got to get a shot.
This reminds him of summer camp with the guys.
Al, we're going to get a shot of you touching it.
Okay, so go
ahead. Well, I mean, we're like everyone else. We were commiserating over the shutdown. We're talking about all of our friends and loved ones that have been affected. And the conversation turned a little bit to some news about another friend who owns a brewery that was having a hard time getting getting his labels approved. That's Justin over at Atlas Brewery.
Right.
Yeah. So we all heard that story, and we were talking about all the different ways that our food trucks that work out of Mess Hall are suffering and all the other small businesses that are suffering. And it was very much a moment of, you know, putting it all together. And Nevin said, well, why don't we try and fix this in some way? Is there some kind of app or crowdsource sort of thing? And I said, well, I know some guys that can give us this and show everything in real time, how many beers have been donated, how many beers are being consumed. And then maybe we can just, I don't know, put some kind of web technology together. And Nevin's like, is that that's sort of like a thing, right? And I'm like, I think it's a thing. It's
right.
Not
is
really
it like crowdfunding-ish, right?
Yeah. No. Ish. I'd say it's microfunding because you know you really are. You can choose to go on and buy a single beer, and that goes to a single government employee here.
So
in
let's
DC.
Talk. Let's walk people through it. So you sure. go to the website.
You go to payitfurlough.com, mm-hmm. and there's a button that just says fund a beer, and you click on that, and you can fund as few as one and as many as you'd
How
like.
How much are the beers?
They're $7.50 each, and that includes the full price of the beer for the participating vendor, the sales tax, the credit card processing fee, and the cost to maintain the website.
And so right now it's only with...
four places here in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say in the not-so-distant future, depending on how little Al and I want to sleep, that there will be a national version of the program up and running to some degree.
Okay.
But
which is amazing.
Yeah. But... as you mentioned, it's been moving really, really quickly. We put it up on a week ago today, and it was a Sunday, it was a snow day, and mm-hmm. there was a lot of like online social media traction for it, which was great. And then on Monday, we started getting press hits, and by Wednesday, it was on CNN and NPR and Condé Nast
Isn't that
and Thrillist.
Amazing?
And no, I mean it does remind you of the speed that of the life that we live in now, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a little...
for better or for worse?
Yeah, no, it was a monsoon, which was awesome because it's a great cause. But I also haven't slept for 10 days.
I bet. So, well, I think what's...
neither of you, but you normally don't sleep, do you?
Occupational hazard.
Wake up,
right,
Al.
Occupational hazard. Yeah, but I think what's interesting about it is that this one's so easy. Mm-hmm. This is an easy way for people to participate and feel like they're doing something. Because, mm-hmm. I don't know, I feel like I'm at a loss. I don't know how to... really, really
You're right.
help.
It fulfills
I want to do
a
something.
Basic need. You
well,
want right. to be helpful. You want to
you
have
can
a
buy
gesture.
Them a beer and you can donate. There are funds to, you know, the question is which are the legitimate ones to donate some money to, you know.
Well,
to,
this one is right. legit.
No. I'm not talking about
I
this.
I mean.
I'm saying that's about all you can do and beat on your congressmen and your senators and on the White House to get something accomplished.
To get something moving. So the beer companies that are involved locally, that's it for local, right? We're going to keep with this for now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But you'll see some additions. Yeah, okay. You'll see some additions in the next few
days. I mean,
are
people reaching out to you left, right, and sideways?
Oh, we've had over 100 breweries.
How can I be involved, right?
Oh, there's 100 breweries that have reached out to us all over the country.
Sure.
Everybody says, bring it here. We wish we had thought of it. And can you bring it to us? So that's what we've been working on.
Sure. I'm sure that logistically that's
So what happens when it's over?
It's over, right?
Well, you know, first of all, we're going to leave the beers in the fund, and government workers who have been furloughed or working without pay have up to 7 days after they get their first back paycheck to continue to redeem free beers with the hope that we'll, you know, substantially, if not completely, you know, reduce the fund. If mm-hmm. there are monies remaining after that, then the beers stay on virtual ice. And we all know that this is going to happen again, unfortunately.
Right.
And so then the beers will just be waiting for the next time there's a shutdown.
Okay. God, so, that's great. All right. Well, tell everybody one more time where they can find it, please.
Yeah, it's payitfurlough.com. So if you are a furloughed employee or a contractor coming up, I'm looking at the live app, at the live website right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got about 2,300 beers that are up for the taking. We've already given out about 1,500.
It's amazing. And again, wow. Name the breweries and locations where people can
get
it.
So it's Atlas Brew Works,
mm-hmm.
DC Brow,
mm-hmm.
and Three Stars up in Chillum.
Sure.
And Shop Made in DC. And all of those are the, they're small businesses that gain the benefit of having all of those beers purchased from them. So there's a lot of good things to feel about,
No, it's excellent. Thank you both for coming in
Thank
quickly
you for having
and
us.
For starting this. It's brilliant and it's very exciting.
We really appreciate your interest in helping us get the word out, Nikki.
Excellent. Absolutely. All right, guys.
You too, David.
Oh, I'm interested. Yeah. I'm thinking about the 2,300 beers I drank yesterday.
Yeah, right.
Oh, maybe this is why your wife's not
right.
talking to you.
He doesn't really drink, so it doesn't really matter.
It's all theater. All right, thanks, guys. Good
anyway,
luck.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks.
All right, so,
much. So
Grace, Gladys, Danny, let's talk Lebanese Taverna. Who wants to give us the...
So, well, I kind of want to start because when I first moved to D.C. Back in the early 90s, I used to go with my friends to the Lebanese Taverna on...
Connecticut Avenue.
Connecticut
right?
Avenue. And I just loved it there. It was so beautiful and it just was... I mean, I was young and I didn't have a ton of money, but I could eat there well.
Affordable.
And right, it was very affordable and the cuisine was so
healthy
different.
And
nobody can hear you because you're not talking in the mic.
I hear you, but no one else does.
Actually, a lot of people think that was our first one.
Well, I mean, I always thought
Where
that
was
your first
one.
Arlington.
Arlington was
West
the first
Washington
one.
Washington Boulevard.
Right. But wasn't that by Colony House?
No, by, that's Lee Highway.
By okay, Lee Highway. I don't know Virginia. At all. But anyway, but that was, to me, such an amazing space. And when David and I first started dating, we went there pretty regularly. We loved it there.
Oh, yeah, we did, baby.
Well, you probably saw Danny.
Absolutely.
That was
There was always
baby.
Somebody in the bank back with a big bottle of wine.
Definitely. But so Danny. Let's talk about the history of Lebanese Taverna, because it's celebrating its 40th year, which is just in the restaurant industry.
Yeah.
Like, that's unheard of. Yeah.
Unheard of.
Really.
Rare.
Well, not just in the restaurant industry, but with your family.
Got a family-run business.
We're still together.
Right. I'm in a family-run business. Trust me. I completely understand.
What?
So, well, you're a husband and wife.
That's right.
Beat us.
Right. But you know what I mean.
You have to go home with them.
Who started? Who started the business?
My parents.
Okay. Let's hear the story.
I can interject here. Yes, it was my parents, and since day one, myself included. Early on, when we first came here, my parents, especially dad, didn't speak English. So when
came here from Lebanon.
He wanted to negotiate the sale of the restaurant, so he would bring me along to help translate. So I've been involved since day one. Even though I was
how
young.
How old were you?
I was going to say, how old? Yeah.
It's 16
okay.
or 17.
So that's so you were all born in Lebanon?
Yes.
Okay, so
I came
how
on a cargo ship, especially yep. him. And
uh-huh. Well, we all were born and raised in Lebanon, except Grace was about a year and a half.
She's the baby.
But during the war, when the war broke out in Lebanon, my brother and I, who were 14 and 16 at the time, joined the military and started fighting. We were going to the front line, and that's when Dad decided,
that's it.
No
Let's
more.
Get out
I do
of
not
here.
Want any of that.
So
and
in the middle of the night.
Middle of the night, we took a cargo ship to Cyprus, where we spent a couple of months doing our papers at the American Embassy.
And
in
did
Cyprus.
You have family here? Did you know where you were coming in the States?
We did. Lucky for us, my grandmother was actually born in America, in Youngstown, Ohio.
She's in the 1920
census.
Yes.
Oh. And I have a copy of it.
Yeah. You know what? I have a copy of the 1920 census. With my grandparents.
And at the age of six, her family decided to go back to Lebanon. So we have an American
thank God
born
it was
and
easier
raised,
to get into the U.S. then than it is now.
Well, lucky for us, because our grandmother, we were able to come legally, but it did take 2 months in Cyprus to process our papers.
Okay, so she was no longer here.
Right.
Nope. She was.
She had 11 kids.
God bless. Okay. All right, so then you come here with your family and you come to the
Arlington,
Virginia. You go to Arlington. Yeah. Family there? Is there a Lebanese community there? Why Arlington?
We have several uncles and aunts living here.
Okay.
Like my sister mentioned, my dad is one of 11, mm-hmm. and he had seven siblings already living here with their families.
In Arlington. So there was a Lebanese.
Yeah.
There was a Lebanese force. They were called the Abinajums.
There was a Lebanese force.
Coming to America, the first site I saw was the Iwo Jima, because my uncle lived right behind it. So from the airport, I see this huge humongous statue of the American flag. That was my first memory of America.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And so your father comes here, your parents decide to open up what?
Well, yes. For a couple of years before we opened the restaurant, we all worked in various restaurants. And then when my dad decided to open the restaurant, we all saved up our money. All our money went into the same...
They were busboys.
Into the same biggie bank.
Okay.
And we all saved up our money.
Now, wait a second. But you came here, so did you go to high school?
I went to high school.
You went to high school, and then you worked.
No.
Worked and went to high school at the same time.
Okay. And so your parents... But the idea was to open up...
Dad always dreamt of opening a restaurant, even though his profession in Lebanon was a customs officer in the ports.
Okay.
He had nothing to do with cooking. But my mom does come from a culinary background. Her dad wrote the first Lebanese cookbook in Lebanon. He was a self-taught, French-educated chef.
Fascinating. Who
knew? And Momstown, where she comes from, it's very well known to producing some of the Lebanon's top chefs. Mm-hmm. And everybody is aware of that.
Does everybody cook?
Everybody cooks.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're known for that. So
is your mom behind the menu originally?
No, my dad and my mom. My dad both had a knack for food. I mean, he loved food.
My dad was passionate about food. My mom had the talent, but my dad had the passion.
Okay.
Right.
And by the way, you notice we say my mom and my dad.
Yeah, it's this translation.
It's the direct translation from Arabic. So here you say mom, dad.
Right.
Our mom.
But
our
we
mom.
Say my mom, my dad is
right.
How
no,
we
that's
translate.
True. Yeah.
Our friends are like,
true.
Don't
it's
you
weird.
Have the same mom?
I'm oh, like, yes, right. It's mine. No, but that does make sense.
Yeah.
The possessive.
Possessive.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay, so they open up.
The first restaurant.
I need the timeline.
So 1979, July 26th is when we opened the first restaurant.
Okay.
After scraping up all our savings, we put together towards this restaurant that was called the Athenian Taverna.
Okay.
And after finishing...
So did people think it was Greek?
Well,
it was Greek.
The Athenian Taverna was Greek.
So they did think it was Greek.
And, but we were converted to Lebanese Taverna, and because we had very little funds left, my uncle and dad were standing outside the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And my uncle says to my dad, you know, you can save half the money if you just change half the sign. So instead of Athenian Taverna, it became Lebanese Taverna.
Okay. But why did he want to do Greek food first?
No, it's not Greek.
And he bought it as Greek.
A pizzeria, sub shop.
Yeah, and actually it was a pizza and sub shop that was owned by Greeks. They had some Greek food in
it.
But
Hold on. Here's what I want to know. Did he speak English at that point, or was he dragging you around?
He dragged me around.
So how hard was it to figure out what you had to do to get all the business licenses and the permits? And
well,
it probably wasn't as hard then.
It wasn't as hard, but he did take me to the accountant with him, and the accountant said, here's what you got to do. You got two columns. One is debit, one is credit. When you write a check, when you make deposit, it's credit.
Wait,
just
can
do
you explain that again? Because I'm really bad at that.
Yeah. He would like you to know that, right?
That is not my forte.
I would just like her to write something down.
And lucky for us, I ended up going to school, and I did take accounting, so that became easier.
And economics.
Me.
I mean, he studied economics.
But did you learn English in Lebanon?
No.
So pretty much a family of seven when we landed here. I have to say, when we landed here, all our possessions in the world were our suitcases and $375. We had nothing left in Lebanon, and we were starting a new life in America, and we all just got to work. None of us spoke English. French was our second language. English, we were just learning it in school when the war broke out. So I think I probably went to one semester of English. So it was, I knew like basic words like cat, dog, door, window, you know, like, but that's pretty much
what's on the menu? Cat, dog, door, window. By the way, I think the Lebanese army is still looking for you and your brother.
Yeah, it's possible.
Where are those guys?
That's a good one.
Okay, so you changed the sign.
So it wasn't, it didn't all happen automatically. So because it was an Athenian Taverna, and because Dad wasn't sure about introducing Lebanese food, he wasn't sure. So we started running the restaurant as a Greek diner.
Because believe this or not, people didn't know what hummus was
or where Lebanon was.
They had no idea where Lebanon
Imagine
was.
Imagine a
is
world
it a country,
before
is it a
hummus.
City? Is it?
They had no idea.
For
no
many,
idea.
Many years.
That sounds
to
like
come.
A commercial. Imagine a world before hummus.
But I mean, well, it is. I mean, if you
and
think about
bread.
The
we couldn't find ingredients.
If you think about the trajectory of hummus to being in a Lebanese restaurant, I mean, there were no Israeli restaurants
from an unknown,
or Mediterranean,
right?
So it was a totally unknown entity, and now it's like there's not just one brand in grocery
it's like
stores.
30
there's
brands
like 30
at Giant.
Brands, right? Yeah. In Giant.
In Giant.
Right.
In Giant.
Exactly. Yeah. Like
I say
like
you know
stores.
You made it when you have prepackaged hummus at Costco with SpongeBob SquarePants on the packaging.
Exactly. Right.
Well, I don't think a lot of our listeners know that hummus is made from SpongeBob SquarePants.
No, but it's true. Like,
The interesting now is that most people eating hummus don't realize it comes from the Middle East. They don't really realize it's Lebanese. Or Israeli.
Right.
For that
I mean,
it's
Middle
become
Eastern.
An American staple.
I mean,
it's
is
become
it really,
an American staple.
But is it prime? It's from all, like...
There's something
there's
called
debate.
The hummus wars.
Right,
there's
right.
A debate.
There's a debate.
Where does it come from?
But it's from the Middle East
yes.
in general.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
it's eaten, and like there's variations, like tzatziki, there's variations.
Baba ganoush.
You know,
baba
let me ask a question.
Right? There's all variations
before the
based
French
on region.
Inserted themselves into Lebanon. I have family that came to Palestine in the 1830s. So was Palestine bigger at that point, and did it encompass part of, I mean, very did it go question. Over the Golan Heights and did
Well, for 400 years, the world knew nothing but the Ottoman Empire ruled that whole world, and there was a lot of exchange of culture and ideas, and of course, exchange of food. So that's why it's hard to tell the origin of a lot of the things, like baklava, for instance. Yeah. You can argue about that all day long.
Turkish, Greek, started. Lebanese.
Right.
Turkish.
You have that on the dessert menu at Lebanese Taverna.
But people
and
think it's
good.
Greek.
People
right,
think
it's but Greek. We don't make it with honey. The Greeks make it with honey.
Yeah.
Right.
Between the Turks and the Greeks, they fight over it. We don't. We cannot claim it as our own. I think the Greeks and the Turks have
a much better argument
for it. what we can claim as our own is the hummus, the tabbouleh,
the kibbeh.
Mm-hmm. Now the falafel, though we make it really, really well, we cannot claim it as our own because we believe it started in Egypt.
What are the breads called?
He's talking about pita. I mean, no, everybody thinks it's pita.
Ribbons? They're so puffed with air. It's
pita is a different thing, but people do refer to it as
pita. The breads that come out to the table
very good,
at Lebanese tomorrow.
David, very good question. Pita is typically thick.
Oh, my God, thick. You're going to make my life so difficult.
You know, if you weren't such a condescending foodie.
Say something else, Jesus.
No, condescending.
In Lebanon, there's no such thing as pita.
No, there's not.
We don't call anything pita.
It's Lebanese bread, basically, and here we just go with pita because everybody knows
it as
pita.
I just have to say this because I am certain that I've eaten there 60 times in the last year because that's where all my meetings are. That bread is like crack.
It's crack.
And
it's crack.
And every time I go there, I say to whoever I'm eating lunch with, I'm going to have the salad with the, you know, the salmon
but you
or whatever.
Have some of the bread.
Because
I
and
need
I'm
to
not
have
gonna
the
eat
meal
any
first
of the bread
before the bread because I get full on the bread.
Well, it's delicious.
With the za'atar that we put on the table for everyone.
Oh God.
Well, I have to tell you the story of the bread. When we first started the bread, I had a lot of resistance from my family because I said, I want to introduce fresh bread to every customer. And they're like, you're nuts.
That
like,
never happens. Resistance
nuts,
from your family?
Let me ask you a question. Is it not traditional?
Oh, it's absolutely traditional.
Yes. Okay. How do you make fresh bread for every table?
But we used to. It was a bakery bought. We bought it from a very good bakery, and we had very good Lebanese bread.
But it wasn't hot.
It wasn't hot and fresh.
And it couldn't come out puffed up.
No, because we make it all day long. The ovens are running all day long.
Wow.
So just to have the bakery line and to have a man manning it all day long, you're talking about a big cost, and we get zero return for it. Mm-hmm. But we do get guest loyalty. We do get people who love our bread and come in just for that. So although we don't make any money off the bread, it brings people back all the time.
You gotta have
all the time.
Through the Lebna and through
and the za'atar.
Right.
And you do that
exactly.
With
and the hummus.
The garlic sauce that people are addicted to.
Right, did you bring any?
Okay, wait. So I'm going to take a break from our timeline here. You brought all this wine. Let's pour one now.
Okay.
So everybody can taste something. And you brought in Lebanese wines.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, you still have to talk into the mic. Tell us first about it and then you can pour it.
All right.
Or Grace will pour it. Okay.
So, basically,
I knew Grace was here for a reason.
I know, massages and wine.
Yeah, we'll talk about the massage after the break. That was really nice.
When people think of Lebanon, they definitely don't think of wine, and they don't think of mountains and white powder skiing. As a matter of fact, we have now.
They don't.
We have snow blizzards. The same thing that are happening in Europe. The same thing that's happening in Europe. And skiing is unbelievable right now in Lebanon. So in the same way, people don't realize that we have amazing vineyards and amazing soil and climate.
Why aren't we doing the show from Lebanon?
You can compare it to California, where in a day's time, you can go from skiing
places. Aren't you drinking? Where? Are we the only ones drinking? Come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
Everybody has
so,
cheers. Okay.
So cheers. Back to wine. Cheers.
Yes.
Back to wine. About 20 years ago, there were only 3 wineries in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And now there are about 47.
But historically, were there wineries before and then they fit, or then, you know, laws changed?
Excellent question, and I can't prepare to answer that.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Okay.
So,
well, just, I only ask the question because we've talked to so many people, and, you know, given what we do on the other radio show and here, people from Georgia, people from Hungary,
Bulgaria.
You know, Bulgaria. Like, there's a deep, deep wine history, and you see these nations that have been making wine forever, and then it it doesn't make them any money, or it becomes something that people just do at their homes. Do you know what I mean?
Is and it, then they is don't it, do but it. But it, has it always been there? Because, you know, this when the delicious. Romans ran so Palestine, were they trucking in wine, or
so
were they growing
it? So this is a great beer? Segue.
Okay, so
the world's largest standing Roman ruin is in Lebanon, and it's called Baalbek. And there they have the Temple of Bacchus, as we all know, is god of wine.
My favorite god.
And so Lebanon had been producing wine through the millennia. Now, we can't claim that we first produced wine. I think Iran and other countries can probably claim that.
The Georgians are taking
but,
that one.
But for sure, we produced it throughout history. But when the Ottoman Empire took over, for 400 years, there was no winemaking.
Drink alcohol, right?
The only winemaking that was allowed was by the monks for the monasteries.
Fascinating.
So it was the monks who kept the tradition alive for 400
years. That's where the phrase drunk monk comes from.
So when after World War II and with the defeat of the Ottoman Empire, collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the French came in and then they started with the wine industry again, and for 50-60 years we only had three wineries.
Well, how many climate zones are there in Lebanon? Because you think of Lebanon and you think, you know, it's Middle East, you think it's hot.
Right,
and dry.
You just think it's hot. Mm-hmm. Like when you said they're skiing, I had
same
no
day.
Idea.
It's four seasons, wow. Like anywhere else in the world. We have summer, spring, fall, winter. The winter can be brutally cold in the mountains, and the summer is brutally dry. The only rain we get is actually in the fall and a little bit in the spring.
Interesting. Okay, so now there's over 40
wineries. And there's at least 20 represented now in America and on our menu here in the restaurant.
Well, we were one of the first to bring Lebanese wine.
Well, yeah. So I know you guys, I've learned this from Grace, that when... and this takes us off the trajectory a little bit, but when Jose Andre and Think Food Group opened up Zatina, he met with you all for menu consultation,
yes.
And he was one of the first ones to sort of publicize when he opened up Zatina. I'm sure you were way ahead of him, but he publicized.
Well, he had the name.
He had the name, and it was, you know, a big fancy schmancy space in the middle of Penn Quarter, right as it was becoming hot. But he was publicizing that the wine program specifically was Mediterranean-based, and it was wines from Greece and wines from Turkey. And, I mean, he got blowback initially because people would come
in. The menu.
You know,
only
people,
three countries that
right,
represented.
People would come in and be like, I don't know what to you know,
yeah.
Where's my Chardonnay? You know, people. But it began, I think, restaurants that were doing that began the conversation, and you have a way more educated clientele now who will walk in and see a wine from Lebanon and be like, I'll try that.
The name Chateau Muzar, I mean, people know it now.
Sure.
Well, Jose and I, we go way back. And when opening Zaytinya, Jose and Robin Roberto consulted Lebanese Taverna on the Lebanese portion of the
Roberto
menu.
Roberto Alvarez
and Rob Wilder.
We sent our chef there to teach them the Lebanese part.
And for the longest time, the hummus on the Zaytinya menu was called Lebanese Taverna hummus.
Yeah.
So we helped them with the Lebanese portion of the menu.
That's what you get.
I'll take it.
And Nikki, absolutely, they were extremely brave. They were the first to go with only three countries, Greece, Lebanon, and Turkey,
right,
with wines. And fast forward, now we're considering going to 100% Lebanese wine, and we had a tasting just 3 weeks ago, and guess who was there? Jose Andres himself.
And his sommelier.
Oh, wait, is that when...
Albert came in. I love Jose.
We had a god walking the restaurant.
Albert is...
Well, it was a total surprise. Jose, I invited Jose for the tasting, and he said he was coming.
Bringing a friend, he said.
Bringing a friend, and then comes.
Right, he just brings in one of the most famous chefs in the world.
And I got... Jose said... Go for it, because I still have a little reservation, like you said earlier, Nikki, that what somebody asks for, you know, Pinot Grigio or Sauvignon Blanc, and we don't have it.
Right, but you have something.
Like it.
You have something like it, and that's all your staff has. I mean, I know you know this, but, you know, look, there's that person who's going to be like, well, I only drink X and I don't want to try it. You know what? Then they lose.
Well, this is why I waited this long. Because now I feel there are enough flavor profiles to cater to all these tastes.
Right.
I'd say 10 years ago, no way. 5 years ago, maybe.
But now?
Now I feel there are enough flavor profiles to cater to everybody.
So quickly, before we take a break, tell me about the rosé you poured, because it's beautiful.
Well, this rosé, I have to
wait,
tell you.
You got
to
talk in front of the mic. You got to be in front of the mic.
I'm tasting this for the first time with you guys.
And Danny, isn't this a new winery?
This is a wine, exactly, that's not available yet. And it's made of Mourvèdre, Grenache, and Syrah.
I think it's lovely.
And it is lovely. Now, Lebanon does produce great rosés. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, this by far is my favorite.
Well, it's done in the Provençal style. So it's, you know what I mean? So it's really light.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah. It's really light.
Do you know where Provençal is?
Provençal. It's in China.
All right. On that happy note, we're going to take a quick break,
Grace,
but we come back.
Who's the fucking idiot on the other microphone? Right?
Stop talking. Just stop talking.
I love you, David.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to try some more wines from Lebanon, but we're also going to learn more about all the restaurants that are now open under the Lebanese Taverna umbrella and what you all are up to.
And we're going
to
eat some fresh bread.
No, there's no bread and there's no hummus.
Thanks,
we'll be back,
Danny,
in just a sec.
We're back on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, and we're talking about the restaurant story of the year, sort of, that Lebanese Taverna is. I mean, how many restaurants do you guys have?
11 currently.
11 restaurants.
Wait, you have 11?
Wow.
Okay, so where are...
I know, I lose track too sometimes.
Okay,
I'm
so
like
wait.
10, 11.
Okay, so what was... So, all right, let's go back to the timeline. You started in Arlington, right? And you changed the Athena... What was it called?
Athenian Taverna.
Right,
to Lebanese,
Lebanese Taverna.
Yes.
Your father creates a menu and introduces the Virginia public.
Yeah,
not even,
Arlington.
Not even,
well,
not even the
no,
D.C.
No, actually,
public.
It's even better.
Because
he introduced it to a North Carolinian who was a contractor who lived above the restaurant and would come for a sub every day.
Yeah, ravioli, steak and
cheese. Rob Williams. Rob Williams. And Rob... Dad kept talking to Rob, and Dad kept saying, I have a dream of of introducing Lebanese food, he said, you know what? I'm going to be your best tester. I've never had anything but American food and Chinese. So,
like a meat and potatoes
so,
kind of guy.
Right. So yeah. Make me Lebanese food. And Dad said, okay, come back the next day. He came back and he said, this stuff is unbelievable. Put it on the menu.
So cool.
Daily, we used to have a special, just one item. We still had all the raviolis and pizza.
Okay.
Every day we'd do different Lebanese dishes for
our
customers.
So at what point did it turn over entirely?
I would say 1981. From 79, 2 years.
And at that point, is this when Phyllis Richmond's working at this point? Like,
no, actually, before Phyllis Richmond, it was Judy Lieberman who discovered
this. Oh, my God. Jeez, that's... Oh, right. We're in the early 80s.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So at what point are you getting attention for the food? Like, at what point are people... Because in the early 80s, D.C. is... There are good restaurants here, obviously, but, you know...
Wait, in the early 80s?
Just let me finish what I'm saying.
My point is
that there were only a couple... You know, listen, there wasn't as many people here, and there wasn't the same real estate, so it was a totally different world. But there was... D.C. was known for pardon the expression, its ethnic cuisine, right? There was...
There was Duke's, there was Dominique.
No, you're talking about the big name restaurants.
I mean,
talking about like Adams Morgan at the time still had restaurants.
It wasn't even that.
Not yet. Adams Morgan was up and coming.
I mean, forgive her. She's from Jersey.
No, but the Ethiopian and those restaurants, weren't they all started? They started in the 80s.
Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't really a big thing.
There were other restaurants.
Every now and then you'd go to, what was it, Marrakesh on New York Avenue to eat with your hands. An AV Ristorante to eat, you know, like Sicilian cheap Italian foods.
So it was in 1981 that Judy Lieberman discovered us, and from that point on, we just took off. And
lines
we
out the door.
Phyllis Richmond wrote 1982.
And Phyllis Richmond after that. Yeah.
We were definitely a destination place. It wasn't like, you know, you got lost.
Arlington was
there.
The suburbs back then.
Right.
I mean, like, really
exactly.
The suburbs. Like,
but she put us
like
on the map.
Out there suburbs.
Like, Reston is now.
I mean, I sort of feel still that way about
maybe
Arlington.
Like Leesburg. Maybe like Leesburg.
Further out.
So then how did D.C., what was next? D.C. came next.
Right.
That's the second location?
Yes.
And?
I decided that I was going to go to school, college, and leave the family business. I thought
obviously, know, that didn't happen.
We had too many egos in the house. 3 brothers and a father. Too many egos. So
I didn't ask this question. Were you all working at the restaurant?
Yes. By that
I was
point,
even passing out business cards in kindergarten.
Oh, my God.
By that point, 5 siblings
I was working full-time.
And 2 parents were working in the restaurant. So after graduating from college, I decided to become a stockbroker, and I went and got a job at Merrill Lynch.
Okay.
It took a week of cold calling. You know, in those days,
we've all seen Boiler Room.
Get the phone books and just dial. And I was like, this is not cut out for me. I had a much better gig where I came from.
Right, I bet.
So I'm going to go back and expand what we have. And that's how it all started.
He was the visionary.
So you moved to the D.C. location.
Yeah, which was also an unusual move in the early days. And probably today still people usually make their name in the city.
And then move
to the suburb.
Sure,
we moved from the suburb to the city. People said you were crazy.
What was the name of the comedy club that was next door to you or near you where they had open mics and all that? Do you remember?
On Connecticut
Avenue? I did open mic there. I know
I mean,
it was there.
I don't
there.
Know. It was
maybe
me.
That was before us.
A lot.
Or maybe I closed it down. But
yeah, I don't know.
And when we came in the city, like in the suburb, we didn't take reservations. We said, you know, we treat everybody equally. We're not taking reservations. And everybody said, you're going to fail miserably. Well, I have to tell you, for a good part of a decade, we had lines
out
the door.
Right, I remember.
And also, everybody was treated equally, whether it was a senator, congressman,
actress.
The wife of the Shah of Iran, actresses.
Farai Diba.
But they all waited in line, and people thought we were crazy. And we're like, I'm sorry, but this is who we are. And it worked really well for us.
But one of the things I don't feel like we're discussing is so you... We're very fortunate to get this traction very early on, and people really responded to the cuisine. But did people come in? I'm sure people were incredibly rude and asked horribly obnoxious questions. But how did you go about educating the American palate? Because I'm sure people were afraid of garlic, were afraid of spicy. I mean, not knowing.
Mediterranean.
Do you know
diet,
what I mean?
Yes,
not
yes.
knowing what the cuisine is. I'm sure there were a lot of questions.
We're actually
really
very lucky because Lebanese cuisine in and of itself is pretty simple. It's not it's not like Indian or it doesn't have a lot of exotic spices. It's very simple food prepared fresh and simple. And so I think that's what was appealing about Lebanese food is that it the palate is very adaptable to many people. There's not strong flavors. It's garlic, lemon, and olive oil. We call it the Holy Trinity.
Right, they're the core.
And that's the basis for so many of our dishes. And it really spoke to people because if you're Italian, there's so many flavor profiles that
complement it, that are similar. Sure.
So I think that was the easy part. I think if it was an Indian restaurant, it would have been a lot harder.
Right, back then. I mean, now there's like an Indian restaurant.
A lot of Indian food, it's not hidden, but it lives behind this curtain of spices.
Yes. Right. And so. I don't think Lebanese food is like that. And as you guys were saying, the Mediterranean diet, it's vegetarian friendly, very vegetarian friendly because...
Which now is so important.
It's huge.
You know what I mean? Like,
besides it being gluten free, vegetarian,
small plate.
Yeah, we've ridden all the trends, right? Pomegranates and their antioxidants. We use a lot of pomegranate in our food.
Sure.
So our nabit, which is the cauliflower.
The cauliflower.
Everything that's a superfood is on our menu.
Right, exactly.
And it's been on the menu for 40 years.
Yes, we've never altered it.
Well, how often... Now you have 11 properties. You have a fast casual concept in Annapolis, right? LebTab.
Are you in the airports, too?
Yes. After 40 years, you kind of have to keep creating.
Of course.
We have to figure out many ways of serving hummus.
Of course.
We have a catering kitchen. We have a commissary kitchen.
It's actually good with chocolate.
We sell hummus by the bowl.
That's
we sell
horrible.
Hummus
that is
so many
so
different
true.
Ways.
Right.
So we're constantly creating ways to sell hummus. So besides our full-service restaurants, we were at the forefront of the fast casual dining. In 1999, we opened Lebanese Taverna Cafe in Congressional.
Yep.
And we said we're going to take our best sellers, our top 20%, and put them on a menu in a casual setting and more approachable prices.
It was
prices.
Like you were like a little before your time on that.
A little before our time.
Right? Like
yes.
Now, that's
isn't
what
that
everybody's
truth?
Doing. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But no, you were just a little before your time.
So now, fast forward, that has done very well for us. But now, in the Lebanese Taverna Cafes, there are so many items that are still cooked to order. And a lot of times that causes a bottleneck. So our new concept, our newest concept is called LebTav.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I say it is, this is where the name and the menu and the timing are abbreviated.
Shorter, yeah. Right.
Okay. You got it, Danny, David.
Yeah, you're Danny.
Yeah, yeah, I'm Danny. The name.
No more wine for you. You're
the name, the menu, and the timing are abbreviated. So now it's truly a fast, casual concept.
So what does that mean? What does it look like? What's the menu?
More of a condensed menu.
Well, what we took away the items that were cooked to order. We literally had proteins, the salmon, the kebabs, that were literally cooked to order, like a traditional restaurant.
Sure.
So we essentially took those away and reformatted the menu in a way that's very approachable, very friendly, and extremely reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And everything will be ready in under 5 minutes.
So shawarma. Falafel, and then we have a braised lamb that's on the menu as well. So all things that are,
prepared,
cut
right,
to
right.
order. Falafel is the only thing that's actually technically fried to order, but all quick things.
But it's so fast.
It's
right.
so fast, yeah.
And that's only in Annapolis right now, right?
Right. And a lot of prepared foods that are prepacked, the hummus, the baba ganoush, the tabbouli. So
it's combining the market aspect of it.
Right, because the market is only in Virginia, right?
The market is only in Arlington. So you can come in, grab a few things for your refrigerator, and take it home as well. So it's kind of being part of all.
So is shawarma Lebanese?
Well, again, that's one of those Turkish.
Ottoman.
I don't think we can claim it as our own. The story behind shawarma is that the Ottoman army, that was a way of cooking for thousands of troops, is over a fire pit, and supposedly that's how shawarma was born. But back to the Lebanese Taverna concept, we do have one in Annapolis now, but another one is under construction in Congressional. We're
the
relocating.
Mm-hmm. You're going back?
Yeah.
No, we're moving in the same center.
We're still relocating.
Open We're still open. That one's still open.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Doors down.
Okay, terrific.
And then Silver Spring will be open in the spring. It's Silver Spring.
Yes. Spring. Now, where is that location?
That one...
It's currently in downtown Silver Spring, like in front of the fountain, but we're actually moving into the old Taylor gourmet space right around the corner.
A lot of free space?
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't know if we should... We're looking at a lot of Taylor gourmets.
Are you looking at the one at the wharf?
And
that's a good spot.
That one is spoken for, but we may be opening a half a dozen laptops this year alone.
How exciting.
Yeah.
That's Kensington, Maryland is a fertile place.
As a matter of fact, it is.
It is. We don't have shit.
There's a new building there.
There's
they're
a
trying
lot
to,
there.
Wasn't there a place
like
called
Wheaton, Maryland
or something?
Not there.
But the great thing about Frankie the laptop concept, it's 1,500 good. Square feet. We can put it just about anywhere.
Yeah, Kensington, not Wheaton.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the wine you poured next.
All right, so now we have one of our...
You still got to speak into the mic.
One of the original three wineries is the Chateau Kifraya. It is a white wine.
God bless.
No, I'm sorry.
That's our first sneeze on
Chateau,
air. Here comes our second. Second.
God bless you.
Bless you.
Chateau Kassara. It is that in Chateau Muzar were the first winemakers of Lebanon. And what we're tasting right now is Sauvignon Blanc, Muscat, and Claret. And Kassara is our biggest wine cellar in all of all the Lebanese wines because they were on the market early, and they produce a wide variety of varietals, and they are really well made.
Well, so the wines, what would you say are the wines? Like, if somebody's like, okay, I'm ready to try some Lebanese wines, what would you say the grape varietals are, so that people, like, when they go in, they're like, I heard this.
What are your gateway varietals?
Right. That's a good way of putting it.
Awesome question. Most of Lebanese wine are made with noble grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And in the French style, because of the French influence.
Sure.
Sure.
Now the Lebanese, just like the Greeks, are discovering some traditional grapes. And I actually have one with us here tonight that we're going to taste in a minute.
Now, is it an orange wine? Because it looks a little amber in color.
And this is actually a very good question because this is a Chateau Muzar.
Which is
a famed Gaston Hochard who put Chateau Muzar. The story of Chateau Muzar is that he throughout the Lebanese Civil War, he never stopped producing. And his claim to fame is that he aged his wines in concrete barrels. And England was his first market where his wines became cult wines, became celebrity wines, and until today they are world renowned. And Gaston Hochard himself unfortunately passed away 2 years ago in a swimming accident in Mexico.
That sounds like a terrible story.
he will never allow me or anyone pour this white wine other than room temperature. He does not believe in chilling his white wine.
Interesting.
And this is
he can't stop you now.
Yeah. And of all the wines I have here tonight.
So if there's a rosy end to that story, he can't stop you from doing
so
it.
So the grape varietal in this wine is called Obeida, and it's truly an indigenous Lebanese grape.
And for the uninitiated, how would you, what are you comparing this to? So if somebody's like, I want to try, or you can't. You're like, you're just going to, you're going to have to trust me.
You're going to have to trust me very soon for the wine list.
I mean, if it was a red, I would say it would be like an Italian Barolo. But I really can, I do not know what to compare it to in white.
It's got almost kind of a witty sort of aftertaste.
It's musty. It's musty. Yeah,
it's good.
It's leathery.
It's funky. It's a funky, funky wine.
Well, okay. Chateau Muzar wines are all funky, and that's why he has such a following.
I could see Psalms. Yeah, but you know what I mean? Like, I could see the sommelier community being loving this. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because it's like, do you know?
They can use all kinds of crazy words.
You know, because they're like, oh, you know, like they'll come up with all these like.
Do you taste the squirrel?
Right.
And the
exactly.
You know, I did taste squirrel.
No, squirrel, I could
I said squirrel.
Roasted squirrel, right?
No, but I could see that community really like. You know, like some of these amber wines and orange wines, and there's some really out there whites that are out there that are really unique and different. And you have to really have a palate that enjoys a challenge in order to drink it.
Yes. And to add to this, this is a 2007.
Oh, wow.
So it's already
you opened it. Really sad. Wow.
Special. Well, no, he won't.
Oh, my God, I had hair in 2007.
He won't release.
Wait, I knew him in 2007. He did not have hair in 2007.
No, but you had attitudes.
He won't release any of his high-end wines unless they're 10 years old.
Well, he won't release anything at all.
Right now.
Yeah. Okay. All right, I have a question.
Wait.
Totally. Okay, no,
go ahead.
I want to go to a business question.
Of course.
One of the things that... I'll ask it another way. One of the few chefs or, you know, food families that has expanded and not hit a wall is
us?
Yeah. Well, no, yeah. I mean, you know.
Yes, 11 properties. That's amazing.
You know, you think about a Wolfgang Puck. He really hasn't. He might have closed a restaurant
or
two.
But that's not a family business.
Well, but it's the Puck family. It is. But
no,
my point is.
No, it's not the Puck family. It's Wolfgang Puck.
Right. So he's got a family, goddammit. I'm making a point here.
Let's hear it.
He's opened restaurants and, you know, he's expanded crazily. But a lot of chefs and a lot of restaurant groups have gone, you know, they started inhaling their own fumes. And they think, well, everything we touch is going to be gold, and then, you know, it implodes somehow. How do you guard against, because really it's still location, location, location. It's still site selection. You've got a winning menu and winning ingredients.
They come to see you.
They come to see us.
Wait. But you know what? I'm going to just add a positive spin on that. All restaurants have to evolve if you want to survive.
Right, yes.
You haven't been around for 40 years because you keep doing the same thing over and over and over again.
I disagree. Take Il Pizzico on Rockville Pike. It's been there since Fred Flintstone was alive.
Yeah, when's the last time you were there?
But I'm saying it's still there. It's still popular. It still has cars out.
But it's one location.
It's one location.
Right.
But we do both. We do both. So we keep the things that people love about the restaurants, the high quality, the family aspect, you know.
The hospitality.
Those things will never change. And then we add new things, different concepts.
Cooking classes.
Cooking classes are huge.
Yes.
You guys were at the forefront of cooking classes.
Again, over 25 years we've been doing cooking classes.
Who leads the classes?
We different chefs of Lebanese taverna.
There was a time when...
Jose Andres, I mean...
Right, you used to bring in guest chefs.
Roberto
I remember.
Zana, Jose Andres, Tagway, everyone.
Well, because no one had a cooking class... space.
Sure.
And so that was once a month we had a guest chef that would come
incorporate our ingredients.
Go shopping in the market.
So Italian with Lebanese.
You do it in the kitchen?
We have a cooking class space at the market.
Oh, at the market.
At the market. Right. Not at the one you're thinking of.
Right.
And we also do full service catering. That's
right. Must be huge. Yes. Go ahead, Danny. What? He needs attention.
What am I going
to
say when I get there? He won't stop talking.
Yes, exactly.
Welcome to my life.
You know, the term restaurant business is a misnomer in itself. And for many, many years, we didn't know the business part of the restaurant business. It was only in the last 10 years we decided to put the business in the restaurant business. We had a consultant who came along and said, you guys got to put the business in the restaurant business. For 30 years, we treated it just like
an extension of our family.
It was an organic, living, breathing organism that we just... tended to and enjoyed, and we had a lot of pride in. We made sure that the customer was happy first, and then we counted the money, or we looked at the P&L, not the other way around. And I think that's a distinction that has kept us alive for so long. And of course, now we have put the business in family business. I mean, the business in restaurant business, but we haven't forgotten the restaurant aspect. You know, it's the hospitality, and to us, hospitality is defined by warmth and generosity. Generosity, like nobody's giving out free hot bread anymore today. You know, you go to most restaurants, they're going to charge you for it. Why? You know, we feel that...
You don't work the cost of it into the pricing of the...
No, it's a loss. It's a loss
revenue
center for us.
The next time I go, I'm just going to eat bread.
Do you know what I think is really interesting? Given the change... of the DC dining scene in the last 40 years, where we've seen, you know, massive amounts of Indian restaurants, Italian restaurants, Spanish restaurants, all sort of Greek, you name it, cuisines, Georgian, etc., being rolled out. you're the only people who are still doing Lebanese. That one other place, right? Wasn't there one place, Bacchus, that closed?
Everyone else is doing Mediterranean. And that's where we feel like we set ourselves apart. Because we are serving Lebanese cuisine. We're not diluting.
We were never afraid to be 100% Lebanese.
Was Bacchus the Auger family? Was that Ulysses Auger?
No, Bacchus was over...
Who was Bacchus?
It was
Jefferson Street.
Yeah, Jefferson Street. Thank you.
That's where I got my start.
That's where he was a busboy. Usama Jalad
was the owner's name. Mm-hmm. And actually, there's a story that I told the other day. I don't know if you guys care to
tell us. Of course.
Is it a good one?
Well, it's a good story. Muhammad Hadid, who is the father of... No, but it's really good. Of Gigi and Bella Hadid, was a regular...
I know he was.
He's telling it. It's happening.
At the Bacchus restaurant, and... I myself, as a 17-year-old, I was serving them all the time. And Muhammad Hadid and our family go way back. And so he truly got his start in D.C. and in Tyson's Corner, really.
Amazing.
So where I live now, he built my townhouse is where I live now.
Oh my God, in the 80s.
Yeah. Yes, he developed that whole complex.
So isn't that a good story?
Well, that's the story?
Well, we don't have time.
I thought he was going to try and hook you up with one of his daughters.
We only have five minutes left.
But I also think we give back to the community. That's another draw to all our customers. They see the good we do.
Well, you're very involved with St. Jude's.
Yeah, St. Jude. But not just me. We all are involved.
No, your whole family. You're very involved in the charitable organization.
How many organizations do we give to a year?
Almost a thousand. Almost a thousand.
Donations. And then we do like over 100
every single preschool, every single, you know, anything Moss, that church, asks
Well,
for
you
us.
Know, the David M. Nellis Foundation for Wayward Older Guys.
Anytime.
I will send you a platter of hummus tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you. We're soliciting donations.
Special delivery.
Well, so let's just, we do have to sort of wrap this up, but at the marketplace, do you sell the wines? Can you buy wines there?
Because, a lot of them.
Yes? Yes. Okay.
Yes, but I also, I want to pour the last wine that I opened.
Okay, pour the last wine, please.
And it is the Chateau Muzard, but this is not the traditional Muzard. It's more
modern. Look at the label. It's a Picasso.
So it's a lot more approachable. And it's actually, I feel
this is a red.
Just a sip.
And I feel this is the best wine out of Lebanon right now.
And the name is called Jean.
So it is a Chateau Muzard, but it's a Jean, which is young. And it's a 2013. And it's Cinsault, Syrah, and Cabernet Sauvignon.
Thank God I'm driving.
It is delicious.
But it needs food with it. It's got an edge to it.
We're only a mile away from the location. I'm not being cheap.
But if I want to impress somebody with Lebanese wines, this is my go-to.
With good reason. It's actually like a classic Cote du Rhône. I mean, it has a real...
It's like a Cote du Rhône.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's got a raisiny backbite. It's delicious.
I love this wine.
All right. So tell everybody, please, where they can find your Lebanese tavernas, where the Leb Tavs are coming, and catering. Let's hit all those marks, please.
So Arlington, we have a few locations. D.C., Annapolis, Silver Spring.
You only have one location in D.C.
We have... Now.
Right.
Right
now.
Now.
Right now.
That's coming. Okay. More are coming. More of the quicks of the Leb Tavs.
Mm-hmm.
Baltimore, we have in a harbor east.
Mm-hmm. Harbor east.
Harbor east.
Oh, right. Close, next but that's not a Leb Tav. That's a full
that's
Lebanese taverna.
That's a full
taverna.
Service Lebanese taverna.
Mm-hmm.
So there's 10 locations. Reagan National Airport, which I still call National Airport.
So it's like
Arlington Hospital. Virginia Hospital Center will always be Arlington Hospital. And then we have our full service catering company, which... You know, we are
catering
the
by LT.
Catering by LT.
Yes, that's what it's called.
That's the business.
And we are like the bar mitzvah, and we do lots of weddings, lots of events.
We have friends who use you guys all the time. I mean,
it's great.
You really get feedback. Yes, absolutely.
We are very lucky to be part of people's lives in many ways. Coming into our restaurants, you know, there's one story that I love, which is. We catered the baptism